Hello, this is Janet Gallen welcoming you to Love Letters Live. And as always, our guest today is somebody wonderful and interesting. And when we listen to our own selves talk about our lives or any aspect of our lives, there is always somebody in there that could get a love letter and would love to hear from you. Always. They just work magic. So today we're going to go right to Jenny Gold. And Jenny, you're a filmmaker, right?
Yep.
Okay, start with you. I mean, how did that happen? And maybe you can talk a little bit about cinemability and what that is. And
sure.
Cinemability, okay.
Yes, I am a filmmaker. I'm a DGA director.
A what?
Directors Guild of America director.
Oh, yes, of course.
Member. And I'm very happy to be part of the guild. One of my goals in life was to come to Hollywood and become a film director.
Okay, can we just start with that?
Sure.
Go back, where were you before then, and what made you want to come here? And
I grew up in Florida,
mm-hmm.
In Miami, and I went to the University of Central Florida Film School.
Oh, so you were directed right from the beginning. How old were you when you knew this?
Well, you know, early on, when I was very young, I did a lot of publicity work with the Jerry Lewis Muscular Dystrophy Telethons.
Okay.
Which no longer exists, but it gave me a lot of experience dealing with cameras and, you know, seeing the guys do lighting, and I am a storyteller. And
okay.
Even in eighth grade, I was doing, you know, films on, you know.
So that was just your natural inclination, is to be a storyteller. I mean, people have certain things that are their natural talents that... Yes.
I guess. And I love photography. So the two kind of are joined together. Okay. And it made sense to me once I realized I wasn't going to be a vet because I turned green at the sight of blood.
But did you want to do that before you realized it involved blood?
Yeah. So, I mean, I thought you just pet the animals. And that's all it was. And I like animals. So I thought, I'll be a vet. But then I grew up and realized that wasn't for me.
A pet vet. That didn't work. Okay. Yeah. Go ahead. That's so funny.
As long as it's fake movie blood, I'm good. But so I went to film school, and while I was there, one of my shorts got a student Emmy, and so that was my first.
What was it about?
It was about the feeling of panic, actually.
In general.
Yeah, and ironically, because it was something, you know, they say write what you know.
Yes.
Ironically, I didn't want to do it, and I had a professor that was kind of a salty old dog that was like, "You have to do that film. It's a great idea." I said, I don't want to do something, you know, personal and something that people will think I experienced. And he said, you have to do it or I'm going to fail you. And luckily, he was, smart to kind of push me in that direction.
Really?
Because it apparently did speak to people and it won the student Emmy.
And don't you think that when people are intimate with each other in their conversation, it's how we learn?
Yeah.
It's how we learn what we can do, what are possibilities.
Well, you know, I was young and more interested in what my fellow students thought of me.
Sure.
And I didn't want them to think I'd ever experienced, you know, panic in this way.
Okay, so can you talk about you and panic? Because everybody feels
well,
that at some point.
You know, sometimes if you, you know, being a person who uses a wheelchair, you know, sometimes if you can't get out of an area or if, you know,
you mean actual physical terror, of course.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
So what I did to cover, like, oh, this has nothing to do with me because I was so naive.
Yeah.
I worked with another student and did a co-production and tried to distance myself. And, of course, you know, I was just naive. The first interview, someone said, oh, do you ever, you know, is this something you know about? And I was like, oh, so much for my veil of secrecy.
But, you know, something, I mean, I think about that just living in Los Angeles or San Francisco. If there's a natural disaster, total panic. How are you going to get out of town? The freeways, never mind.
We were in New York.
Touches everybody.
We were in New York on the, I don't know, 57th floor of a hotel. That the hotel had been doing some construction, which we didn't know, but... They kept tripping the fire alarm.
Oh, my.
So every time it does that, you know, the elevators stop working.
Yes.
You're way up high. So you're thinking, that's not really a great place to be.
No.
So yeah, there's some concerns. You know, there is a movement, just kind of to get off topic for a second.
No, go ahead.
For natural disaster and disability preparedness preparations. You know, what do those people do if they're in that
situation? So how does that differ? I mean, if you would talk about that for a minute,
you know, I'm not naive.
Oh, you don't.
And my plan was jumping out the window, so I'm probably not the best person to talk. But because I'm a writer, then I always have these, you know, wild imagination scenarios.
Well, I personally won't stay over a fourth floor because I was told by a fireman once that that is the highest floor you can jump out and be caught.
Well, if you're not caught, it would still probably hurt.
No, yes, but they're there with the blanket?
Yeah.
You know, in that case. Okay, so...
You know, the view up there is really great, though.
You like that. Okay, so you're willing to chance it. All right. So go ahead, back to your sensibility and...
I am so
your own journey and your work.
In photography and cinematography and having experience in front of the camera as a kid for the telethons. I kind of had a little interest. And then when a film program opened up at the University of Central Florida, I knew that's where I wanted to go. And UCLA and USC were a little too far for me to go at that time. In hindsight, maybe it would have been great. But the University of Central Florida was really, really good experience. And after I graduated, I shot my first feature film.
What was that?
It was called Ready, Willing, and Able, and it was an action film that we did on a very low budget, but back when, before, you know, all the video.
And where did you do this? In Florida?
In Florida.
So I have a question, if I may. How do you just start? I mean, I shot my first feature film. Easy to say.
Well, the
shorts.
What's
your first... But still, what do you assemble a cast? You get yourself a director, you direct. What do you do?
I'm the director, and I learned early on in film school that my path for this business wasn't going to be the same as my peers, who would start working for a company as a production assistant and work their way up. But that's kind of a very physical job. You're getting coffee, you're sweeping up, things like that. So I had to take a different approach. So my approach was writing and, you know, so I could hire myself as director and also producing, because that way I could do the films that
I
wanted.
Okay, so, and I totally lost sight there for a second. I don't know what happened, that you're a film school graduate, so you learned how to do these things.
Yes.
Okay.
And in the film school that I went to, it wasn't where they selected one filmmaker to do a project. Everyone had the opportunity, if you could also learn how to produce, which was finding the means, finding the money, finding the crew, putting everything together. So I think it was a really great learning experience that everyone had the same opportunity. And thanks to my short films in film school and winning the Student Emmy and having another film that did really well in festival circuit, it gave me enough, you know, experience and wherewithal to try to launch a feature, which is a film that I wrote based on the resources that I had.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we wanted to do an action film because we knew a stunt team. And
oh, I see. Okay. Yeah.
In Florida that wanted to showcase what they could do, and that gave us a lot of bang for our buck, as Variety said when they reviewed the movie.
Can we see that somewhere?
Yeah, right now it's on Vimeo.
Okay, Vimeo, so people.
It also, you know, this was a while ago. It had done the circuit internationally, and it won some awards. And
so I just meant now to catch up. And the title again?
Ready, Willing, and Able.
Ready, Willing, and Able. Okay, so when did you then make a transition to Los Angeles? And
actually, for that film, when we came out here to do the post on it, because I couldn't find the caliber of talent that I wanted, and we knew that it would be here. And, you know, this is always, California's been kind of calling me for a long time.
So. Now you say we.
My husband.
Oh, okay. I didn't know who was with you in this. Okay.
Well, at the time, we weren't married. We got married after we came to California.
But I wondered who the we was.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
And so what do you do now? And then you were talking, I read something where you were talking about disability in film, but you talk about cinemability in that, if you would.
Sure. Well, when I came to Los Angeles and started our production company called Gold Pictures, I was looking at different projects to do, and an article was written about me as a female director who uses a wheelchair, which is, there's very few female directors working anyway, so some good friends of mine had seen it, and they came over and they said, we want to pitch you an idea. I said, okay. So they came over and they said, we want to do a documentary about you. And I said, no, I haven't done anything. What do you do, follow me around? I was like, bad idea.
Oh, I read that you said, yes, okay, go ahead.
So I said, but if you want to do something on disability, And right there I had the idea. You know, why don't you do it on the power of the media and the portrayals and how it's been from the silent era to today? And by the way, I probably know everybody you could talk to. And they thought about it and they said, it seems like a lot of work. And boy, were they right. You know, 10 years later.
So they didn't want to do it because it seemed like a lot of work, whereas following you around with a camera is easier.
I guess. Yeah. I don't know. I mean, they're great people, and it was just a choice. I didn't speak to them. And so I said, well, just so you know, I might do it one day. I wasn't committed. I was like, yeah, I might do it. I thought the idea, it's kind of interesting, I might. And I sort of put it in a file cabinet in my office and forgot about it. And was working on narrative films because that's my first love, storytelling, fiction. So, and I've never done a documentary before.
Oh.
So I had a friend who was a publicist to come over to our office and say, take a look at everything, give me some advice. Because I wanted to, I like pursuing good advice when I hear it. And he came over and he found this in the file cabinet. He said, what is this and why aren't you doing it? And I said, well, it's about disability. I don't want people to think that's all I do. I want to do other films about other topics.
But you've never done it before, right?
Well, Ready, Will, and Able had a character who was a wheelchair user.
I see.
Which actually was pretty unique because she was, a gun-carrying, action hero. Mm-hmm. Who happened to be a female and happened to also use a wheelchair because she had been blown up in the first scene.
Okay, so you didn't want to, yeah.
So I didn't want to do that really again. Actually, I didn't want to do it the first time. And then everyone said, you get to blow stuff up. And, this will be great for an independent, low-budget film. People will want to see something different.
Were you the actor in this one?
No.
Oh, okay.
It was a woman named Chris Templeton who had a disability in real life, but she could stand and walk with a cane, which made it really convenient because we could shoot her standing before we blew her up.
Okay.
Once we blew her up,
how handy.
Yeah. It was very convenient.
Yes.
And we became very good friends over the years. But, in fact, she is in CinemaAbility as well as everybody else I know, practically. But the film came about because he found it in this filing cabinet and said, if you don't do it, who will? Who better to tell this story? And I like good advice when I hear it, and that's what he was there for. So I started pursuing it by starting to talk about it to people. And then before I knew it, the Farrelly brothers were on board and asking when it was going to air. And once, people like that want to know, you're committed.
Yes.
And then one celebrity after another, it was sort of a dominoes effect. The more we got, the more we wanted to do it. And
how long ago was this?
It's been about 10 years.
But you did it.
Yes, it's done. And we are, bringing it out now. We're talking to a lot of different people right now about different avenues for the film.
Oh, so we haven't been able to see it yet.
Well, it's been doing private screenings with our partner, who is Regal Cinemas. And Regal's been very supportive of us. And our other partner is the Braun Corporation, Braunability Vans. So we have a van that's wrapped with a logo that we've been crossing the country. We have a great picture, Anna, from San Francisco, of the van in front of the Golden Gate, which is awesome.
Well, I'd like to see that.
Yeah, okay. I'll
send
it to you.
Maybe you could send it to me.
It's a great picture.
So what is it? What are some of the issues that I read that you were talking about that makes such sense? Where maybe you could talk a little about the history of disability in film, because it's a little goofy. Well, I shouldn't say that because somebody's made these choices, but it does seem to me a little goofy that when people who are using a wheelchair or are different in some visible way, they are cast as that person.
Yeah.
I mean, that kind of typecasting seems a little goofy.
Yeah, it is, but it's sort of embedded in our culture.
So how did that get that way? I mean, there are lawyers in wheelchairs.
There are. There are entrepreneurs that are multimillionaires. There's everything. But people, when they think of someone with a disability, because maybe they don't see them that often in their workplace, they think of them as someone on the street corner selling pencils. So employment is kind of a subplot of the documentary, if you will.
Because that would be handy for people to realize this.
And mainly it's really about acceptance of people for what they can do. And not just, we don't just cover disability. We cover the power the media has had in shaping people's perception of yes. different minority groups, whether it be women or people of different ethnicity or race and or sexual preference. It covers pretty much. We try to touch everything.
Well, because I shouldn't say everybody, but most people have something visible that distinguishes them.
Right, and then there are also people with mental issues that maybe aren't visible. And
right,
and the thing is that instead of prejudging what someone can do or the asset they can be to as a friend in the workplace or in society as general, people need to just sort of be more open. And I think that's kind of what we touch on. And we do it in a way that surprises people.
What's
because
that?
The film is entertaining and funny at times. When I sit with audiences in different regions of the country, as I said, we've been going across the country doing specialty screenings. At first, sometimes the crowd is cautious and they want to be politically correct.
Oh, that's a big issue, isn't it?
Yeah,
is that the cautious you're talking about?
Yeah, they don't know if they can laugh. And we have I have a very dark sense of humor, and so do a lot of the people that are in the film. And slowly they start to get with the program and relax. And by the end, you know, they realize they, you know, are laughing. And Peter Farrelly came up to me after the screening. He's like, "You had a great film. You got more laughs than some of my comedies." And I counted once. We have about 11 really solid laughs. 9 are really good, and I think the rest are sort of chuckles. But we entertain. And that's why when I say I'm a storyteller, I really want to hear the audience react. I think a lot of people got into the business because of Star Wars. I got into the business as a kid from watching Jaws, Steven Spielberg's Jaws, and Rocky, because both of those films had a big impact on the audience.
That's what you noticed.
Yeah, and Rocky, you know, people would jump up and cheer, and in Jaws they were screaming, you know, and it changed how people would go into the ocean the same way Psycho changed, you know,
showering.
Showers.
Right.
And I'm a big history buff. I love film. I love, the old stars in the films of the 40s and the 50s and just everything. So and I realized this was an opportunity to explore film history and the impact film has had on shaping society, I realized it was something that I should do.
I think the history of this disability in film is really fascinating.
Yes. It starts, you know, even in the very first Edison film.
He had a film
called The Fake Beggar, where a guy pretends to be blind and disabled he's on pretending that he can't move his legs. And then the cop comes by and busts him for being fake, and he gets up and runs away.
Oh, so he's a buffoon.
Yeah.
Yes.
Well, and a faker. And so,
yes,
and that kind of trend continued. It also, there was a trend of the sweet innocent, which is someone who usually gets healed in the end because they're sweet and innocent. And then there's the angry avenger who is...
Oh, yes. Superheroes who...
Well, like they're angry because of like... blaming someone for their, you know, like Ahab and Moby Dick, for
I
example.
See.
And these are kind of trends that other filmmakers would just kind of copy and continue. And part of it may be that the writers or the directors don't have someone in their own life with a disability. And you'll notice in shows like Breaking Bad, where Vince Gilligan knew someone who had CP, that when he wrote a character's son who had CP, it was very authentic, and he cast someone, R.J. Mitty, who really had CP. And he says in our film, he didn't do it to be an activist. He did it because it felt right.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, when you can do it, well, one of the things we cover is casting. When should somebody cast an actor who really has that disability, or is it okay not to? And I tried to, in the film, you'll see that I show both sides.
What are both sides?
One side is that casting someone without a disability in a disabled role is akin to blackface. And the other side is you know, acting is acting,
yeah.
And sometimes you need that name. And who could, you know, Ray?
But also anybody can play anything.
Right.
A good actor can play any range.
Right. And Jamie Foxx was brilliant in Ray. And, you know, who else would have been that, you know, amazing in that role? So, and films won't get made without the star power. So you have to do a balance. A friend of mine, Ben Lewin, who did The Sessions, you know, was a great film. And he cast a lot of people with real disabilities in the film. But the lead had to be someone with some name value.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, there are reasons. And personally, I don't really, I let the audience decide for themselves. But as a filmmaker, I believe in
cell phone?
Oh, sorry.
That's okay. Cell phones are a part of life.
I always have it off. That is so funny.
That's okay. That's kind of a nice trumpeting I am here announcement. Okay, go ahead.
I always have it on vibrate. How did that happen?
Well, it does. I'm not so offended by cell phones going off by accident.
Oh, good.
So I wanted to, you touched on something before that I find really interesting, and we kind of went over it, but if I could go back, you talked about when you were doing the tour, you know, with the van, and people didn't know if they should laugh.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there is something. I have a friend whose career it is to teach people how to laugh in dire circumstances. And this is, you know, people who have had, you know, cancer surgeries and amputations and all kind of, you know, fire burn victims.
Mm-hmm.
And he teaches people how to laugh amid crisis, financial loss, any kind of life-altering,
mm-hmm.
awful circumstance. And it is such an interesting thing to do because, you know, he doesn't put it like this, but the answer to how can you laugh at a time like this is real simple. You're laughing. Is real simple. You can. If something's funny, you can laugh. It doesn't disrespect the pain or the injury or the misery
sure.
or the challenge. So when you're talking but people need permission to know it's okay.
I,
how do you give them that?
Yeah. And I have a friend who's a fireman who was in New York and lost a lot of friends in 9/11. And he does a laughter heals.
Oh, really?
Yeah. You know, events. But in our film, we added humor because we knew that's the way to get a message across.
Yes.
Must entertain, and because I don't want people to take medicine. Actually, somebody said to me, you know, it's funny because sometimes people would come not knowing what they were going to see. It was maybe a festival or an event, and they were dragged by somebody else, and they had no idea what the movie was about. And then I get these letters. Like, oh, I didn't know what it was about. It was amazing. I never thought about that. You know, people that are able-bodied, you know, or people that maybe have a disability themselves that maybe nobody knows, and then they share an experience or a family member or something. And I've done other films, and I've never had people write afterwards so passionately and say things like, thank you for making this movie.
Oh, I'm going to cry.
Yeah, I don't. You know, it boggles my mind.
So you really did the right thing.
I think so.
That young woman who didn't want to do something on panic because you didn't want people to see you.
Right.
Write what you know. Yeah.
Right. In a documentary, you know, it was not something that I didn't consider myself a documentary filmmaker, but mm-hmm. now I really did enjoy the process and the experience. And I think that this film is unique in that it can entertain. It's got, and I put a lot of star power in it because I wanted the message to get out.
Yes,
and that's the way to reach people. And so now we're in talks with some people about, you know, bringing it to television and getting a wider distribution.
Well, I am eager to see it. I'll look forward to that. I want to thank you for doing this and telling this story. You are really good at it. And if I was going to ask you, which is always my question, if you were to write a love letter right now, who would you write it to?
You know, it's interesting because we were talking about cinemability, and I think it is a love letter to Hollywood. So I think I've done that one, but my love letter
is... So, now, just go back a minute. How have you done that one? With your work?
I think the film, cinemability,
I see, the film itself. Okay.
It's really a love letter to Hollywood because it's not admonishing them for portrayals. It's just showcasing. But I have a huge love for the film history and the business in general, and I think that is what that is. But if I were to write one today, it would always be to my husband and and my family. So,
Who else is your family?
My parents and my two sisters, and I have brother-in-laws.
Oh, so you've got a lot of people.
Nephews and nieces, but they are my supports. And I think growing up with my parents teaching me that there was no such word as can't really helped in a business that is tough, you know.
Yes.
It's tough to be a female director in Hollywood in general. And when you add that you're directing from a wheelchair, people assume that you're not going to be capable of helming the show. But
And why is that?
You know, because I use a wheelchair, but I just tell them that my director's chair goes 12.
Mouth seems to work fine.
Yeah, my director's chair goes 12 miles an hour.
Yes.
And really, I think that having a disability my entire life growing up has made me a better director, because I've had to communicate what I want, maybe not physically being able to get it myself, but find ways of making people do what I want, which is ultimately what, you know, directing is. So.
I have a question. I am big about, you talk about loving history, so I've got a homework assignment. If you ever feel like doing it, you're a huge part of film history yourself. You've just stated, 12 different ways in which you are. When people find a letter in your handwriting or signed by you, and they will be touching something that has felt the touch of your hand, what will that be like to somebody who finds that in 100 years?
You know, it's funny because I think a lot about how we've become so computer-centric and email that, you know, it's very rare these days that I write anything by hand because I'm using email all the time or texting.
But what about a couple of letters?
It makes me wonder about history because, you know, in like
you
World
won't be
War
able to,
II,
you won't be able to access, that's right, you won't be able to get this. These machines will be defunct.
I know, which is sad.
Yes.
I think that's really sad, and I think that's sad about
But letters
film.
Are the perfect information storage.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
I think for the same reason of letters and handwriting, they're not even teaching my nephews and nieces.
Oh, I know, cursive. I know.
Which is awful. But in film, to relate letters to film, you know, digital is the new medium, and it won't last as well unless it's archived and changed from
Do you have? Do you have? That's right. So you can spend the rest of your life going to the places that will the experts who will do this. But I have letters that are over 100 years old, and they look like they were written yesterday.
Right, and a lot of people won't do that because of the expense. So we're going to lose our art form.
Right,
which is films. And you know, I found films from Edison's first film. You know, we have these old ones that we can. And yeah, they needed some restoration, but they're still there.
Right.
And I'm afraid of the current films.
That's right. So what if you took, I understand how this movie is your love letter to Hollywood, but what if you accompanied it by, you actually write a letter about, it doesn't have to be hugely long, about why you were doing this and why it's, you told us here why it's your love letter to Hollywood. But that's not what you said in the movie. I mean, it'll be an additional
right.
piece of important information. What if you just write that down, mail it to yourself, stamp it and mail it to yourself, and open it and read it, because sometimes you find the you who wrote it and the you who reads it are two different people.
Right.
And you just stick it in some treasure box and let a stranger find it, let a niece or nephew find it in 50 years from now.
Yeah. It'd be interesting. You know, and because this film is not archived on film, who knows if the film will be there, you know, because it is a digital film.
I mean, would you consider doing this as a historian and a...
Yeah, sure.
I think it would be great. And also, I mean, you touched on another aspect is you get letters. You got a lot of letters from people who saw this movie.
Emails.
Oh, emails. Ah.
Email letters.
Okay, then I have another project. Print them out on good paper and stick them in a treasure box?
I should.
Oh, yeah, you should.
Yeah, because...
This is huge what you're doing.
Yeah, you know, if we can reach everyone, and that's our goal, you know, world domination. We want everyone to have the
Simply
experience.
Enough.
Because, look, if I heard about a film that was a documentary and about disability, I probably wouldn't want to see it. It'd be like, oh, it's going to be depressing. It's going to be one of those. But that's not what we made. And so we have, yes, we've got Ben Affleck and Jamie Foxx and all these great people, But what's more important is that people feel excited and up when they leave the theater.
Yes.
And they learn something, too.
Yes.
So that's like someone said, oh, it's not like taking medicine. Well, it wasn't supposed to be.
A little bit of sugar.
Yeah, a lot of sugar. And hopefully you're not going to be diabetic because we made it a lot of fun. And that's the whole point. I want people to experience it.
I mean, think.
There is part where people are very quiet because we're saying something serious. And so every time we screen it, even though I've seen the movie a million times, I listen. I sit in the back of the theater and I just want to hear. And different regions react to different parts of the film differently.
Mm-hmm. Oh.
And that's really
depending
fun.
On cultural habits of response? Or
Yeah.
Interesting. I never thought of that.
Certain things hit certain people differently. They're more interested in maybe the politics part of it, or they're more interested in the comedy part. It just depends.
Sure.
But we always kind of gauge to see which is working, which isn't.
Well, I'm looking to a really future time where somebody will find this letter and where you describe this movie and your goal and why you're doing it, maybe a little about yourself, and have somebody find this in a long time from now, maybe not so long, but let's say 100 years, and be able to look at this and crack up and say, look at this. Mm-hmm. Look at this. There was a once upon a time where people in wheelchairs or people with cerebral palsy weren't cast as lawyers.
Yeah.
Can you imagine anything? I mean.
Yeah. Somebody told me once that I think it was Cameron Mannheim, that said she would suggest to her producers, why don't we have the judge be someone in a wheelchair? And they go, well, then everyone will be wondering, why is that? And what's the story on that? Rather than just is.
That's funny. They don't ask that story if they see someone who's blonde.
Right.
When we know they're not. But also, a judge is a wheelchair. You won't see the wheelchair because he's behind it.
Right, right.
Yes,
or blind,
you could do better.
Or whatever.
Yes, right.
Yeah.
So interesting. Thank you for doing this with me. I learned a lot, and I am. Will you let me know when this movie is out?
I will.
You'll let everybody know.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
Somehow.
We will
okay.
exchange information, and
thank
and
you.
Hopefully we can get it out to everybody. In the meantime, you can always go to cinemability.com.
Yes.
It's cinemability. They share the same A. .com and there you can sign up for our newsletter.
Oh, so you'll get an automatic notice when it's out.
Yeah, and also
wonderful.
Be part of the team. We call it the Campaign for Inclusion because we want to include everybody. And one of the reasons we work with the Regal Cinemas is that they have great devices for people that have hearing issues and need special devices and closed captioning and things like that. So so we're all set.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, so as life goes on, if you have more projects to talk about or anything else you'd like to share with me and my listeners, will you come back?
I would love to. I'm getting ready to do a feature right now that is going to be sort of a new thing for me and just something fun that has nothing to do with changing the world.
Okay, thank you. So let's talk about that next time. You're not ready to say a title or anything?
Not yet.
Perfect. Okay. Goodbye.
Thank you.
Everybody. This is Janet Gallen and Jenny Gold saying goodbye. And please remember that if you think you need to wait for a special occasion to write a love letter, writing a love letter is a special occasion. And the subject of it is staring you right in the face. All you have to do is open your eyes and find it. Bye.